Izamit Carr, and I'm Telly Concepcion, and together we are Beyond the Numbers Podcast. We go beyond the numbers of sports and life to bring you the story within the story of the stories that matter. So come learn, grow, and have some fun with us. We are Beyond the Numbers Podcast.
On today's episode, the guys discuss race in America through the lens of Major League Baseball, how the league has addressed race in the past, and how they are addressing it for the future. They also share their reaction to ESPN's 30 for 30, Long Gone Summer, about the home run race of 1998. But first, their numbers of the day.
My number for the day is one. It comes from NASCAR, which admittedly, Amit, I don't watch. But there's only one black driver in NASCAR. His name is Bubba Wallace. And he actually pushed to have the Confederate flag banned from NASCAR events and has been successful. There's been an outpouring of support from his fellow drivers this week and the past few weeks, and it's definitely been something special to watch.
Yeah, I would argue that Bubba Wallace has gotten more support from NASCAR in the past 2 weeks than Colin Kaepernick has gotten from the NFL in the past 3 years. My number of the day is 51-9. Telly, as you know, baseball is back. So I know we're excited about that. And we're looking at a 60-game regular season with an expanded playoff. But 51-9 is the Dodgers' record, best record, in a 60-game stretch in 2017. Now, that means that the Dodgers are the only team since the 1912 New York Giants to win more than 50 games in a 60-game stretch. For our first story, racism in America through the lens of baseball. How has baseball addressed race and racism based on all the things that have happened over the past what feels like months, but really the past 30 days. So, the numbers. 11-3-2-15-7. 11, and that's 11 teams, don't have more than one African-American player on their 25-man roster. Not their 40, their 25-man roster, so the main roster that they have throughout the year. 3 is the number of teams that currently have 0 African-American players on their 25-man roster. 2, as in twice as many African-American players were in the game of baseball in 1989 when Ken Griffey Jr. entered the league. And in that year, in 89, there were 15 African-American players in the All-Star game, including Bo Jackson, who was the All-Star Game MVP. Of those 15 African-American athletes that played in the All-Star Game, 6 of 15, were inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. For a little bit of a comparison, our last number was 7, and that's 7 African-American players that were on the 2018 All-Star Game. And we looked at the numbers from 2019. It has dipped from 7, but I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, that's pretty startling, Amit. So for those that don't know, recently surrounding the death of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement, Tory Hunter revealed that he has a no-trade clause in all of his contracts he's ever had due to racial tensions in one city. But first, we'll get to a bit of history. So in 1947, when Jackie Robinson took the field for the Brooklyn Dodgers, he ended over 50 years of segregation and broke Major League Baseball's color barrier. There were other players in the Negro Leagues who were more talented than Jackie, such as Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson. But Branch Rickey, the general manager of the Dodgers at the time, knew that the man he chose had to be special. The pressure he would face as the first African-American major leaguer in modern baseball would be tremendous. And just imagine the time frame when this was taking place as well in society. So he chose 28-year-old Jack Roosevelt Robinson from the Kansas City Monarchs to be that man. Ricky made Jackie swear that he would not react to the expected criticism and hatred that he would face. He wanted a player who could win over the hate with professionalism and talent, and he felt Jackie Robinson was that man. His own teammates threatened not to take the field with him, and opponents did the same, and each city brought the hatred to new heights and limits. But all Jackie did was keep playing baseball, and boy, did he play it. He played it very well. He won Rookie of the Year in 1947. He went on to have a Hall of Fame career. He was the league MVP in 1949 and retired with a lifetime batting average of .311. What Jackie Robinson and Branch Rickey did in 1947 opened the door to all of the greats that followed. Just think about that list. Satchel Paige, Willie Mays, Frank Robinson, Hank Aaron, just to name a few. He may not have been the best player in the Negro Leagues, but he was definitely the best man for the job. And since Jackie Robinson played in 1947, a lot of things have changed in Major League Baseball. Frank Robinson became the first black manager when he led the Cleveland Indians in 1975. And people of color make up approximately 43% of MLB players at one point. However, the biggest jump has been in the number of Latino players playing in the major leagues. By 1981, 18.7% of MLB players were African Americans. However, that trend sharply reversed, and in 2017, only 6.7% of MLB players were African Americans. The shift can be attributed to a Major League Baseball's push to find talent in Latin America. We can definitely talk about that another day, especially the Dominican Republic, which is highly regarded for finding talent there. But Major League Baseball was a pioneer, Amit, one of the first leagues to address race and racism. And this was in 1947, and the Civil Rights Movement took place in 68. So this is even before that time. So where does baseball stand today with race as it regards to race?
So let's, before we jump into that, I wanted to say, you know, there was, you know, in 2018, actually, 47% of the league was composed up of African-American players, or of people of color, some minority players, right? The biggest jump in Latino players was 23% at the time, right? And we saw the African-American population in the major leagues go from 18.7% all the way down to 6.7%. So really, you saw that Latino population flow in and completely overtake. And to your point, what you stated, you know, it was because Major League Baseball shifted their focus. They weren't looking at, you know, local talent. They were looking overseas. And so we can definitely talk about that. But, you know, at the end of the day, we are where we are today. The league did take such a big stance in 47 in kind of making that. And look, when we look at what happened over the past month, the Black Lives Matter movement has taken the front seat in everything. And it's become the popular thing to back now, right? Every corporation, every company, every team in one way or another came out and said some sort of statement, in many cases very, very quickly in the first couple of days. It took Major League Baseball 9 days to address the issue, right? When we look at NASCAR with what happened with Bubba Wallace, I mean, that was immediately dealt with. They denounced it. They all stood behind him immediately, right? So there was such a big contrast with this league that was the pioneer in what they felt was race relations, and baseball being America's pastime was supposed to be this beacon to show what the rest of the country could and would do over time. Right. And because of that, Major League Baseball celebrates Jackie Robinson Day every April 15th, right? Celebrating the integration. And if you look at it, you know, like we said, some of the greatest players in the game are of African-American descent. We had looked, you and I had looked at this a couple of days ago. We were talking about home run leaders, right? And we looked at the top 10 home run hitters in Major League Baseball history, right? And we found that, what, I think 7 of them were African-American?
Yeah.
You had Jim Thome.
Well, folks, Babe Ruth. Folks of color.
Yeah, but that's crazy, right? So definitely had a big impact in the sport. And, you know, you brought up Torrey Hunter earlier. I think this is a great segue to that point you made, because he really came out and spoke. And we've seen a lot of baseball players, Torrey Hunter, Gary Sheffield, a lot of minor league players. They've all kind of come out and said their individual stories over the past couple of weeks. But Hunter's team that he has a no-trade clause to, Telly, is, we all know, the Boston Red Sox, right? Yeah. And the Red Sox just happened to be the last team to integrate in 1959. So, what is that? 12 years after the Brooklyn Dodgers integrated in 47? My math right?
Yes.
So,
The crazy thing is, too, like you said, Torrey Hunter has a no-trade clause in all of his contracts that he will not play in Boston no matter what, no matter what amount of money they give him, anything like that. And the reason Hunter said he wouldn't play for the Red Sox is as a result of being called the N-word in Boston over 100 times during his career, which is startling because he played in the 90s and 2000s. We're not talking about a guy that played, 40s, 50s, 60s. He hears the N-word consistently when he plays in Boston. Adam Jones, who plays outfield, he played outfield for the Baltimore Orioles. He told USA Today's Bob Nightingale that some fans at Fenway Park berated him with racist language during a game on May 1st, 2017, and that a disrespectful fan, quote, threw a bag of peanuts at me. I was called the N-word a handful of times tonight. Thanks. Pretty awesome.
And for what it's worth, the Red Sox, so Hunter came out with that statement, and the Red Sox, I think the same day, came out and said, yep, this is true. We've seen the evidence. We've seen it in videos. We have to do better, right? We've heard the audio, and our ushers have reported this has happened. So they were pretty quick to say, yep, he's right. We stand with him. There was no denial. There's no, I don't know what he's talking about, or these are isolated incidents. They understand that. And so, you know, to see the team itself say that is pretty big. And you got to think, the Red Sox probably have one of the, has to be the most popular African-American player in the game right now, had in Mookie Betts. So, that's a franchise that definitely has some work to do. But, you know, as we see and as we kind of see some of the responses from teams across the board, you know, there's work to be done everywhere. And I think it really starts in the minor leagues. We've heard numerous minor league players come out on podcasts, come out on interviews with ESPN, Sports Illustrated, talking about how Black players in general, if you just look at a scouting report, so if you want to look at a blind scouting report, you don't see a name, you don't see an age, you see no, you know, racial demographics, none of that. The terminology, the words that are used by scouts always refer to Black players specifically as raw and toolsy and are always considered high risk, right? And these are the same players that have been playing in the league, you know, have been going through, you know, minor league baseball, T-ball, high school, college, junior college. They've gone through the same process. They have been honing their craft just as long as anyone else in the minors. But for some reason, those specific players have always been considered high risk. And it's so funny because it's so ingrained in the system that everyone knows. The players know. people talk about it. I remember hearing it over and over again. You don't necessarily see those terms put in, you know, whenever someone's inducted into the Hall of Fame, you see their scouting report, right? So we'd probably have to go back and look, but I don't think Derek Jeter's has it. I don't think Ken Griffey Jr.'s has it. May not be written in there, or they may have left pieces out of it, but we can definitely go back and look and see what they specifically had said about them. But we see how, you know, this is how people are essentially marginalized when they're coming through the league, and that's how they're referred to, and that impacts how teams look at them, right? If you're a small market team and you see a high-risk player, you're not going to give them the money, you're not going to give them the opportunity, because your professionals on the street are telling you, hey, this guy's you're taking a chance with them. But, you know, going back to the numbers that we talked about, you know, we're at 6.7% in terms of, you know, African-American players in the league as of 2019. Where did they all go? I mean, I grew up playing in Little League Baseball. Plenty of players in Little League. In fact, plenty of players even in high school. Where you see the drop-off, for me, it's been college. And you are a college athlete, you know sort of what how that process is, and what it looks like to be a college athlete. That's a big, it's a big piece. It's a big commitment, right? When you go to college and you try to play at a D1 program, D1, D2, D3, that's your identity, that's your life. And when it comes to baseball, probably more than any other sport, that's your feeder into the pros. And so we look at scholarships, right? Scholarships are so key for athletes, and specifically minority athletes, in many cases, to be able to have access to school and to be able to further their craft and continue to pursue that dream. So we looked at the numbers in terms of scholarship availability, right?
Yeah, we talked about this in a previous episode as well, but it was worth highlighting and bringing back to the forefront just so people understand.
And it's such a big deal because, look, a baseball team, baseball in Division I baseball is offered 11.7 full scholarships in Division I, right? That's 35 players on a roster. 27 of them normally will get some sort of athletic aid. So you have to break up that 11.7 scholarships among 27 players. And yeah. In many cases, that's not going to be enough. You're a football player. How many guys do you have on the team?
No, we had 100 guys, 100 to 120 guys on the team. And
how
football,
many scholarships?
NCAA D1, 85 scholarships. And basketball is 13. And it's funny because you see it because football ends up being very diverse. You have a lot of black players. You have a lot of white players. You have a lot of players from all over the place. But I remember very vividly going to UF baseball games, watching them play Florida State, watching them play UCF, watching them play Arkansas, Georgia. You name the team. Usually never saw more than one black guy per college team that came to visit, unless it was HBCU. So, and I think most of the time I was there, we had no black players on the baseball team at UF, and then we finally got like one or two. So it does make a difference, the scholarships.
But it turns into an access conversation, right? And now we talked a little bit about this, but Rob Manfred wants to hit some of the basic, you know, institutional issues, some of the things that they feel they want to hit the core issues behind some of the inequalities. Finding ways to get more scholarships, not just for black players, for players in general. If you want to increase, you know, any sort of involvement in your sport, and you want to increase the number of quality players coming through your pipeline, you can't force the NCAA to do anything, but you can definitely ask. You can definitely take some steps forward to do that. So, you know, from a scholarship standpoint, I think that's a piece of it. In 2019, Rob Manfred and his VP and Chief Diversity and Inclusion Officer visited Howard University, one of the country's top HBCUs, historically black college or university. And his goal to go there was to recruit African-American executive candidates. Their whole goal was to go there and say, Major League Baseball is this place for you, and we want you to be part of our league. And Rob Manfred was the first active sports commissioner to visit any HBCU ever. So those are actual steps, right? Showing people, hey, this is a place for you, creating the steps and the path to get there, right? So that's a step. It's a small step, but it is a step. And so, you know, there's some hope there in terms of the outreach and the cultivating of the various cultures that are living in baseball. So, and then, you know, when we talk about players, when you watch the game, when you hear the game, from commentators, from coaches, one of the things I remember, baseball is very steeped in tradition. There's all these unwritten rules. And so, you know, part of one of the things you hear as a player all the time is playing the game the right way, right? And really, that means playing the game in this some sort of whitewashed, no excitement, you know, no, you have to play very, very calm. You do what you got to do. You go out there. If you strike someone out, you don't look at it. You don't do anything. If you hit a home run, you just hit it and you run the bases. You don't really do anything. It's a very boring, monotonous, why are we even here? It's like you're playing chess, right? Baseball is often referred to as a chess game. And the right way often feels like, well, you just have to move like chess pieces from place to place. And we see it in the World Baseball Classic when they talk about, you know, well, we as the American team, Team USA, this is how we play the game. You see those other guys, the Dominican guys over there, that's a whole different game. That's just how they were raised.
Right? Lots of power, baby.
Yeah, these Latin players, that's just how they were raised, right? And that's just how they play, but it's not how we play the game. And so if you show any kind of emotion, you showboat, you know, a bat flip. Oh my God, 5 or 10 years ago, a bat flip. Do you remember when Joey Bats did the bat flip? I thought the whole league was going to break down.
Also Dominican, but yes, I remember that vividly.
But that's considered some sort of disrespect to the game, right? But if you throw a ball at one of their best players, all of a sudden you got all 50 people running in from the stands, coming in from the bullpen, everyone's out there and they fight, right? And that's considered, that's just honoring the game, right? That's part of it. that's living up to it.
Right. Yeah, and if something happens in any other sport, basketball, football, where the rosters are more dominated by athletes of color, players are quickly slapped with the thug label. And, you know, but hockey players come to blows and it's like, oh, that's the hockey way to play. You know, you pull
it's
off
the mask and
you just punch each other. If two black guys started doing that, like two football players took helmets off, pulled their jerseys over their head and started punching, people would lose it. But it happens in every hockey game. People cheer for it. That's why people go. There's guys on the bench, their whole job is like, oh, this guy sucks as a hockey player. He's just our fighter. We send him in
our
to
enforcer.
Fight for us. Our enforcer.
Yeah,
yeah.
Enforcer. Man, you got to remember enforcer from Mighty Ducks, man. Come on.
Enforcer.
Come on. That's a position. They couldn't shoot or skate. They could just run and beat people.
Right.
No, but so that's been the history of baseball, right? Like that whole very proper and prim. I mean, look, it's crazy. But we've started to see a shift, right? So, you know, in 2019, we saw the Let the Kids Play initiative. You know, they're trying to, I think they've realized that this is an opportunity to get people excited about baseball and the fun of it, right? There's so many different things that go on in a game, you know, whether it's the bat flips or it's a pitcher getting excited after a big strikeout or making a crazy play in the stands or in the field. There's so much there that you can enjoy. And I think, you know, that's a big piece of what will bring more players in general to the game. I think, you know, Griffey said earlier, probably earlier this year or even last year, he had talked about how, you know, baseball has been losing kids, new talent to football and basketball for years because football and basketball market their athletes better. They show the fun side of the sport. Their stars are all over TV, whether it's commercials or this or that. They're there. They're visible. Mookie Betts, I bring him up because I love Mookie Betts. He played for the Red Sox. Can't stand the Sox, but I love Mookie. He was the American League MVP and World Series champion in 2018. He did not have his face anywhere in baseball. You didn't see a commercial. There was nothing. The most I saw about Mookie Betts was when he went to the celebrity PBA bowling tournament and bowled a perfect game. That I saw on ESPN. That I saw things about. Man, the PBA was pushing that. Like, hey, come play, come bowl. It's fun, right? So I think baseball has a marketing issue when it comes to their diversity and inclusion. I think they have an accessibility issue when it comes to that. I think those are all pieces of it. You know, I played Little League Baseball, but I played in a different country, right?
Yeah.
So I had a very different, you know, when I played, you know, I got a chance I get to toot my horn and live my childhood dreams a little bit again. But when I got to play in the Little League World Series in 1998. There you go. See, look how old I am. In 1998, but I played for Europe, right? I lived in Saudi Arabia. We played in Europe. And we came into the tournament that way. And that back then, it was a different game. There was only 8 total teams. You had Central, East, West, and South in the U.S. And for international, you had, Japan. So it was Asia, Europe. Oh, man, I got to go back and look. But there was only 4, Canada. It was Asia, Europe, Canada, and Latin America was the 4 international teams. And so it was a group of 8. It was a big deal, but it was nothing like it is today. But still, it was a very different, you know, I saw all the talent from all over the world. I saw all these different teams that were very, you know, all an entire rainbow of people, you know, of all shapes and sizes, colors, backgrounds, and socioeconomic statuses come together to play at a very high level for that age and compete together. That was exciting. But you just don't see that follow through. It just drops off after high school.
I would argue it's a retention problem. It's not a promotion problem. We all play Little League Baseball. My sister played Little League Baseball. You know, like I think most of America, that's what you do. You play Little League Baseball, you play T-ball. That's how kids grow up. I mean, I played Little League at Belmont Heights in Tampa. That was predominantly Black. Produced the likes of Dwight Gooden, who captured the NL Rookie of the Year, Cy Young Award. Gary Sheffield, 9-time All-Star, won the NL batting title, hit 509 home runs. Derek Bell, Carl Everett, Vance Lovelace, and Floyd Humans. You know, like Belmont Heights was the league back in the day. It was formed in 1968 after Tampa's racial tension erupted into riots, and local parents felt a baseball league would provide a constructive activity for the area's youth. And I think that's what a lot of baseball was around the country. And it quickly matured from activity to dynasty. And I can't brag because this was before my time, but Belmont Heights reached the Little League World Series in 73, 75, 80, and 81. And they won the Senior League World Series in 82 and made an appearance in 79. But then you see this shift, and this is kind of what we talked about with scholarships and sports and people seeing people like themselves in different sports. Maurice Crum played there. He was a 2-time football national champion and a first-team All-American with the Hurricanes, Miami Hurricanes, with the U in football. And football gained popularity in the 90s, and you saw more young Black men playing football. And that became the sport where you can show out to your case, have fun, show out, run, high step, Deion Sanders, Heisman, do all those things. And in baseball, if I'm excited and throw my bat, I'm getting a fastball to my head.
It's a retention issue, and it's keeping people interested, and it's showing the fun parts of the game and letting, to the point Major League Baseball had it right, let the kids play. When you talk to professional football players, talk to any professional athlete, part of that love is being able to play the game you played as a kid at that level and with that level of joy. I don't understand why baseball, all of a sudden, you have to go from enjoying. You think of how much fun little leaguers have, how much fun high schoolers have, how much fun college kids have, and then all of a sudden, it's got to turn into going into some sort of suit and tie environment where everything has to be prim and proper in some unwritten, idealistic way. So we have an opportunity to bring in a new generation of talent in general. And as we start to address some of the issues of making all players feel welcome and included in the process and as if they have a fair shot, I think you have the future is still bright if they take the right steps. So for our final story today, we're going to talk about ESPN's 30 for 30 long gone summer. More importantly, we're going to touch on baseball a little bit. So I was pretty excited about this for pretty much since they dropped the initial, not even the trailer, the teaser that it was coming. So I'm going to allow myself to go second as someone that's been waiting for this. Telly, you're a baseball fan. I get that. You're excited it was a 30 for 30, right? But you're more of like the average fan, right? Or closer to the average fan. I would say you're more interested and in the know than most average fans. But I would also say that you're not like, oh man, baseball's on. Let's turn that on. What, game seven of the regular season, 1:30 in the afternoon? Let's watch that. So I know you're not there. So what were your thoughts as a fan?
I told Amit we got to start recording because we were having a great conversation about this. But I was just as excited, man. I'm Dominican. This was about Sammy Sosa, the race. That's when I started watching hardcore baseball because he was like the first major star you can watch on TV. And he's in the home run race that they're showing every other day. So, you know, it's a country pride thing. So baseball's in my blood. But Amit, I got to tell you, man, I think saying this thing fell short would be an understatement. And I feel bad because I've heard interviews with the director and he did a fine job. But they made this thing sound like, during the documentary, they made this thing sound like the most important thing that's happened to sports. The largest sporting event since the 84 hockey team beat the USSR. And I'm like, well, this took place in the summer of 98. Didn't we just watch a 10-part documentary about the greatest of all time taking his team for the last time on The Last Dance, winning a championship in Chicago, where Sammy Sosa also plays? And they basically made this sound like it was way more important than any of that. The first three-peat Michael did, the second three-peat Michael did. Oh, and by the way, not only did the greatest in the game just retire just a few months before baseball started, but they didn't even make it that exciting. It was such a back and forth. Mark and Sammy were going at it. And the documentary just didn't do a good job of showcasing that. I mean, the guitar riff during the at-bat didn't build any suspense for me. I'm sorry. That didn't build any suspense. And it was really more about Mark than the race between him, Sammy, and Ken Griffey Jr. It was like, okay, here's a documentary about Mark McGwire's life, Little League, college, pros. Oh, by the way, this guy named Ken Griffey hit one the same day he did on opening day. By the way, this guy named Sammy Sosa was a little funnier than he was in interviews because he's pretty dry. Other than that, Mark was definitely going to hit 70 and get the record the whole time, uncontested. That's how the documentary was set up for me.
Yeah, you know, it's it's funny that you said that. First of all, the only you have a Hall of Fame Dominican pitcher. Maybe one of Juan Marichal. Maybe Juan is okay.
I couldn't watch him on TV. I couldn't emulate him. He wasn't on TV kissing peace signs to the camera. Sammy was in the TV.
He retired in 75, so even if he was on TV, you ain't gonna see him. But that's not the point. I digress. Like you, I was disappointed. And I was disappointed for many reasons. And unfortunately, if we talk about the documentary, it's going to be tough because I got to believe most people didn't watch it. So it's going to be harder for us to talk about things that happened. So we're going to approach this from a sort of a top down. Here's some of the facts, some of the interesting pieces that you may want to know, but you don't want to spend an hour and 47 minutes watching something that you're kind of bored with, but you want to get the hot take from it. You want to get the bite-sized piece of it. So we'll run through those, but honestly, I was disappointed. I think we did a better job last week or 2 weeks ago on the laying the groundwork for that season than they were in laying out the season.
Humble brag. Humble brag.
I'm just saying. I think there was more information because I don't think they actually see the cool part about The Last Dance and even about Lance was you learned something new. There was stuff that you didn't know about. This was literally just a regurgitation of 1998. They just really pulled together a lot of clips of this was on SportsCenter, that was on SportsCenter, this happened here, that happened there. There was a video, a VHS tape. Telly, I know you watched this on YouTube. We can post it up for the fans. We can retweet it on Twitter so you guys can watch this one. This was the chase for the race. MLB Media made this in 99, and I remember I have this on VHS. That was well done. That was exciting. This happened. That's pretty much all I can say. It occurred. It kind of reminded me of baseball. It was nice to think of, you know, people did play, but it didn't capture that excitement back and forth as much. I was mystified at why they opened with this dude that just had the ball. But anyway, let's just, we don't have to talk about that piece of it. Let's hit what was important to you. What did you catch that you may not have known? Or, you know, if you had something else, to, you know, what stood out to you? Talk to me.
Yeah, I will say I'm the biggest swing and miss, pun intended, of the doc is that there's no sports on and there's no baseball on. So this was an opportunity to really make people fall in love with the game of baseball and get excited about it. And like you said, both of us, we're into baseball. We're sports guys. We're going to watch regardless. But the average casual fan that may be curious about it could watch this. You know how many people knew nothing about basketball, watched The Last Dance and was like, I'm going to go shoot 50 shots in the gym right now. I cannot wait to learn how to play this game or watch when it gets back on TV or how many pros were tweeting about it. I don't even know if that many pros were tweeting about this. LeBron tweeted, hey, no Ken Griffey in this. What's up with that? So, you know, I digress. Like you said, what was interesting about this? And we'll give it to you guys. We'll give it to the Beyonders. We'll do the hard work here in the research. Harry Carey died just before the season, and I didn't realize that. So basically, the Cubs were like an average to below average team for all these years. He was the most beloved and well-known Cub, okay, which says something about even the players they had around that time. So they dedicated this season to him and expected nothing from this season, basically. And Mark McGwire's first at bat as a little leaguer, home run.
That was probably the only unknown McGwire stat that they threw out there. That one, and what kind of got me by surprise, Mark McGwire was a pitcher. When he started his baseball career as a kid, he was a pitcher. He always liked to pitch. He was always a pitcher. And they found out that he could kind of swing a bat too. So that was, to me, that was kind of cool to see him make that conversion. And, you know, all pitchers hit, of course, as you go through Little League and through high school and college. But clearly his bat really woke up when he got to USC.
Yeah, and he was so much so he could swing it back. He broke the USC record and hit the most home runs in college. And when he was in college, he didn't know Sammy Amit. They look like the best of friends, but he didn't know Sammy until Sammy hit 20 home runs in June. So just to give you some, I didn't know who that guy was. I heard some dude hit 20 home runs in June. Had to look him up. Yeah. Same division, same league, play each other like 20 times a year. Had no idea who Sammy Sosa. Well, actually, I know Mark was on the Oakland A's first, then Cardinals. So I take that back. But he didn't know who Sammy was until Sammy hit 20.
And I'll give McGwire a pass, right? Because he was traded over halfway through the previous season, so he didn't necessarily get the full force of that. But I mean, I thought it was kind of funny that Sammy would go home and watch ESPN after the game to see if he made the highlight reel. Like, how funny is that? The dude goes and plays, and he's literally at home watching ESPN to see if his home run made it or something he did made it on the show. That's crazy. What a weird, what an interesting motivator.
From a shoe shine in the Dominican Republic, like he said, he had no pressure on him, but he wanted to perform and he wanted his career to have some notoriety to it because he wasn't getting any attention to this point. So one of the places we really felt like it missed, and Amit and I touched on this at the top, Sammy and Mark tied at number 47, and that was played at Wrigley Field. Okay, so they got to celebrate each other. They tied 12 times on it. 12 times they tied. And they hit home runs on the same day 21 times. the documentary barely touches on. It doesn't even show these guys were tied but one or two times. It doesn't show they hit home runs on the same time, but the same day, but only once. And the crazy stat that ESPN threw in going into a commercial break, they asked the question, how many days did Sammy lead the home run race? The answer was zero.
Zero.
Zero. Anytime Sammy took the lead, Mark would hit one that night or that day to pull within a tie or go ahead. The documentary showed none of this drama. None of this drama. There was no sweat, basically. It was like Mark was going to take the lead no matter what. And they didn't do a good job of like building this drama between these two great players.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a big miss for them. But, you know, I think one of the things that you caught on this that surprised you outside of just, hey, how did you not play back some of this back and forth drama that came up every night was supplements for steroids. They caught Mark with Andro in his locker room during the season. Now, of course, at the time, it was legal, right?
It was in his locker. It was in his locker, and the press said, yeah, we saw this thing in his locker.
Yeah.
We asked him questions about it, and he said, yeah, he had injuries three or four of the previous years. Yeah. He said, they told me it helped with injuries. You can buy it at GNC. It's over the counter.
Yep.
You guys can look into it. I have no problems with it. And Mark hits up the company, Amit, right? He calls the company, and what do they say? He's like, hey, I use this for injuries. Like, can y'all, like, help me out?
Nope. Yanyo, sir. Yanyo. But
so he wouldn't back him up that it's something he used the same as you would use a vitamin or vitamin C so you don't get a cold, or vitamin B12 so you have a little more energy during the day. He said, yeah, that's all I was doing with it.
And this brings up an interesting culture in baseball that, you know, I think in many ways led to the steroid era and what happened. Guys have always used stuff. One thing or another since the beginning. Even Hank Aaron admit that they used to be called greenies. And you take a pill and it give you energy. And part of it was you're playing 162 games plus the postseason. That's a lot of games. You get one or two days off a month. You're traveling, you're going. So I get that was part of the culture. So this didn't shake anyone. It's like, oh, yep, just one of those things the guys take to make it through 162. So that was just the culture at that point, and I think that's where that background that you kind of fall into. I thought it was really cool to see Joe Buck. I'm a big Joe Buck fan, unlike 93% of baseball fans. I love Joe Buck. I think he does a great job. But it was cool to see him cover the national games. So anytime the Cubs Cardinals national televised game, you have Joe Buck doing the play-by-play and a lot of the replays they showed. Well, his father, Jack Buck, longtime famous announcer for the Cardinals, is doing the local game for the Cardinals and doing that. So that was cool to me to kind of hear that and see that take place. And to your point, McGuire did some damage in South Florida, didn't he?
In Miami, boy, he went. And he was hitting, he was going up for all the records while he was in Marlins Stadium. The funny part about that, Amit, is basically the stadium was so empty that they had tarps in the back. So he was jacking home runs. He hit 57 there. He hit 58. And then he hit 59. And so, you know, people were trying to get that ball, and one kid like was running over the tarp and like busted his head on, you know, the tarp gave way underneath of him and he fell and busted his head.
But leave it to the Marlins, right? Those games were sold out, but they were sold out to the capacity that they left it at. So they had all that space tarped out. The rest of the stadium packed, but where he's hitting him, tarped over. So leave it to Miami management to say, you know what? Let's just keep it covered. It's fine. Let's make it look a little weird that these guys are on epic home run battles on primetime and it's falling into tarped stands. But that was just unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Yeah. And I think the other crazy thing that I found interesting of the doc was Mark said they never had time to talk. Like him and Sammy Sosa never talked. And they show, you know, they were basically whisked in a golf cart into the press conference. They did the press conference, they were whisked away, and it was literally before the game, so they had to go warm up. be with their teams. They never really had time to talk. The other perspective I think that was really interesting, Amit, they only talked to one pitcher, but you were a pitcher. How would you feel if the other dude just jacked one and then we're just going to take like 30 minutes? He's going to run around the field. Your outfielder's going to come up and give him a hug. He's going to hug the family of the dude whose record he broke. Meanwhile, you're like, dude, my arm is cooling off bad here. Like, you know, I can't just sit here and not throw a pitch for 30 minutes.
Yeah, but, you know, that it was one of those things. It was very interesting to watch, you know, when he hit. When he came around the bases and hit home plate, he hugs the catcher. He hugs the catcher, right? It was one of those, like, it didn't matter what team you were on, you were kind of rooting for him. And he talked to me, he's like, I'm not going to groove it to him, I'm not going to throw it right down the middle, I'm going to make him hit my pitch. But if he does it, he does it, right? And that, I mean, if you look at McGuire, he was hitting home runs, a little number for you. Every 10.61 at bats, he would hit a home run to his career. That's his career number. So every 10.61 at bats, he's going yard. So it was just a matter of getting enough plate appearances before he was going to knock one out. So, I mean, I think pitchers understood that, and I get it. That fortunately, it was only that one time, right? He hit 62, everything slowed. Could you imagine if they did that for 63, 64, if for every pit? Oh my God, that'd get crazy. Yeah. But no, you get cold, you stop. It's like you got to warm up again. Your arm gets it happens quickly, and that looked like that was a 45-minute situation there, where they brought like stands out and they brought everyone out to the field. I mean, it was a celebration, and that was earlier in the game too. I think it was the fourth inning.
Yeah,
it was the fourth or fifth inning of the game.
It was the fourth inning. Yeah,
it was the fourth because Maris hit his in the fourth inning as well.
Yeah,
when he hit 61.
And they were talking about the comparisons. Yeah.
So, I mean, it was cool.
Not a lot of drama there. Again, they tie at 65. No drama. I mean, that's a huge accomplishment. When you think the record on it, Roger Maris was 61. Two guys are tied at 65. We know because we did our research. We watched the old videos. But the documentary basically fast forwards past 65. Like, yep, no big deal. They're both tied at 65. Like,
and then they just went to 70. No, they just went to 70. And that's, you know, I won't talk about Griffey because Griffey has a documentary on MLB Network on Sunday at 5 p.m. Eastern. If anyone wants to watch, I'm excited for that one because that's going to be about him. And I was very disappointed that they didn't even interview him for this, or maybe they couldn't get him. Maybe he didn't want to talk about it. But I mean, they got nothing out of that with him. But they were tied at 47 apiece, and he was at 42.
Yeah,
47 and
right on the heels.
Nothing. Nothing. So it was disappointing. You know, we saw it was national news. You had both presidents. You had President
definitely transcendent sports.
You had President Clinton talking about it. You had President Bush during the GOP primaries talking about it. Although Bush was angry that he traded Sosa for Baines. Baines is a Hall of Fame player. Now, he traded for Baines at the end of Baines's career, so that was definitely a timing problem, but he probably traded for him because he was a Hall of Fame player, not realizing that he was well past his prime.
You gotta set the backdrop here. This was at a presidential debate, and the question was, what is the worst mistake you've ever done? Yeah. The answer was, well, I traded this guy named Sammy Sosa for Harold Baines when I was the general manager of the Texas Rangers.
But
that was the biggest mistake. History will show otherwise.
But, you know, and then, you know, of course they close it out with some of the performance enhancing pieces.
Test. Let's wrap this thing up. So in today's episode, we discussed race in America through the lens of Major League Baseball, how the league has addressed race in the past,
how they're addressing it for the future, and what programs they've implemented. And we also shared our reaction to ESPN's 30 for 30, Long Gone Summer, about the home run race of 1998, mostly about Mark McGwire, but also Sammy Sosa, and our feelings on that documentary. Thank you for going beyond the numbers with us. We're a weekly podcast dedicated to going beyond the numbers of sports and life to bring you the story within the story of the stories that matter. We're available on all major podcasting platforms, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts. Whatever you're listening on now, please be sure to click the follow or subscribe button to get our latest content.
And remember, you can find us on Instagram, Beyond the Numbers Podcast, and on Twitter at Beyond TN Podcast.
Until next time, peace.